My name is Amy G., and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Dustina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Randy will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Randy, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other so that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Please join in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Joseph will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Thanks.
Thank you. Martin G. will read the traditions.
I'm Martin, I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, each member of Alcoholics Anonymous, getting old. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. AA must continue. Oh, that's a long form, sorry. Where is he? Okay, getting very old. Okay. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Amanda.
Hi, I'm Amanda. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know if I'm supposed to do this. No. I want to, I'm really liking the, I love Atlantic Group attire. I never thought I'd say that, because lately it's been justifying the purchase of new outfits. And all day I was just like, I want to thank Eleanor for my new outfit. Because, I mean, every time I have to speak, I run out and I buy something. But my sobriety date is July 30th, 2000. The Atlantic Group is my home group. Stephanie is my sponsor. Atlantic Group has been my home group for all my entire sobriety for 7 years, since I think day 30. I walked into the beginner's meeting and was terrified. Jimmy thought I was somebody's daughter. And, I got sober when I was 20. It was right between my sophomore and my junior year. And I just made amends on Sunday to my old basketball coach from high school. And she was like, when was the last time we spoke? And she brought me back. So the last time I spoke, it was about maybe 10 months before I got sober. I was in the middle of a soccer season, and a week before that, I fell off my bed. I was a little hungover, and I cracked my head open, and I had about 12 stitches in my head, and my coach was very mad, so I was a people pleaser, and I was living all on fear. Fear and alcohol was my driving forces of how to survive, and so I played. I had a game the following Friday, and I played with my stitches, and I'm in there, and Andrew's laughing. I'm in there, and I get elbowed in my stitches. And the ref just, get off the field, obviously. He removes me from the field. He kicks me out of the game. And all he was saying was, like, get off, recover, and we'll let you come back on. It's no big deal. And I cursed at him. I called him something that wasn't acceptable. And I got kicked out, and I got suspended. So I went on this binge. I was like, this is, I was upset. My mom was like, please come home. I've had a couple of concussions that season. She was like, can we just rest? I was a mess. And she had me for a second. I was like, maybe I'll come home. And then I realized that, like, I could drink all weekend. Like, we usually played Fridays and Sundays. I could drink now on Friday and Saturday. So I went out in such a bender. And Saturday night, I was hanging out on the Upper West Side, and I was crazy drunk. And I went running, and I dove through some bushes, and I fell down a flight of stairs, and I hit my head just a little bit to the left of my stitches. And I got up, and I continued to run, and I continued to drink. And it was when my friend, my roommate in college, Nicole, was She was like, I'm done. I can't hang out with you. She was my closest friend. I'm scared for you. I'm terrified. You scare me every time we go out. I can't drink with you. I can't hang out with you sober. We're just finished. And I had to live uncomfortably with her for the next couple months. And, my drinking, what happened was, is that, like, I would, the book talks about the physical allergy and the mental obsession. There was one time where it was like I had drank in a bottle of Black House the night before, so I couldn't really drink the next day because it hurt. And someone was like, just have one beer. And I fought it off for about 10 minutes, and then it was like, all right, I can have one beer. And I went on, it was 4 o'clock in the morning, I was drunk again. And that's how it was. And when I woke up one day and I wanted to stop drinking, I couldn't stop drinking. I'd make it 4 days, 5 days, and something would click inside of me that said, you know what, a drink would make it really comfortable right now, because I was extremely uncomfortable. And I knew I had to stop drinking, and I just couldn't. That was basically how I got here. And what I did, I was looking for a quick fix over the internet. Maybe a little something to read, and next thing you know, I'm drinking fine. I'm controlling it. And I found this online sponsorship list where you can email people. And at this point, like, when I grew up, I was very social. I was talking to everyone and their mother. Like, you couldn't shut me up. I was having a good time. And then my drinking and my alcoholism brought me to a place where I just couldn't talk to anybody. I couldn't look at anybody. I just couldn't show up. So going to an AA meeting was out of the question. I had to go to one when I was 16 because I was a little drunk for a basketball game. And it was like, I knew it was there, but I wasn't going there. So I emailed this woman, and she didn't email me back for a couple of months, but she finally emailed me back, and we started communicating through email, and she shared her experience, strength, and hope through an email. And it was the first time that I connected to somebody that actually knew what I was talking about, because I was going to lots of therapists, lots of friends, and no one really understood what was going on. They were annoying me because they didn't get me, so I gave up. But this woman was like, I know what it's like to start drinking and not be able to stop. I know what it's like to have friends to be like, what's your problem? Why can't you stop? And she talked to me back and forth. And we communicated back and forth, and finally she was like, she did it perfectly. She didn't tell me about AA until I asked. She was like, I drank like you, and now I don't. And I was like, that's cool. And then I was like, well, how'd you do it? And she was like, AA. And it was like, mm. And she was like, I don't know else how to get sober except through Alcoholics Anonymous, so really, I can't help you. And it was scary because it was like, here's someone that finally understood me and I was going to be alone. And I didn't want to lose this. I had a good feeling. I don't even know what it was called. It was just a good feeling that somebody finally understood me. So I started going to AA. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't expect to stop drinking. I didn't expect to make it this long. I went back to college. I had to go back to preseason. I had a much better soccer season. I did have one concussion. That was a head injury waiting to happen. I had a very good season. But what happened was is that I met Maria, who was a member of the Atlantic group when I came in, and she just sent me a note. I couldn't talk to people, so people who came up to me that were like, here's my number, call me, I'll be your sponsor. Like, I ran. Like, there's people that came up to me and just gave me a note that said, my name is Maria, here's my number, come meet me tomorrow, it's a great meeting. I responded to it, and I met her at the Atlantic group, and she became my first sponsor, and this woman threw me right into the book, and threw me right into the steps, threw me into service, threw me into prayer. You know, there's five things that I've been doing since I got sober. It's like, I pray, I go to a lot of meetings, I work the steps out of the big book with a sponsor, I sponsor people, and I have a service commitment. I think that's it. And I've been doing that ever since. And that's the only way I know how to get sober. I can't give you, like, you know, magical words of wisdom that's going to save you tonight, but I wish. I would have saved myself a long time ago. But, like, that's it. That's the only way I know how to do it. And the transformation that's happened for me is that, like, I'm still the same person. I still have that physical allergy. If I pick up a drink, I'm not going to stop. I doubt I'm going to make it back because I have too big of an ego. But I have the same personality. I have the same type of likes and dislikes. The only difference is that I'm very comfortable in this world. You know, the amends that I was making, she was like, you know, is it hard for you to go out and not drink? And, you know, everyone's drinking your age right now. And it was just like, no, because I'm just comfortable. And I'm just so happy. One of the best gifts was, my little cousin, he hates it. I know he hates it. My little cousin Andrew has been so special for me since we were very little. And he played sports. That was the only reason why I liked him. And we didn't know each other very well. And my aunt calls me up, and he's got two other siblings. And every year I get a phone call. Can you take Raymond to an AA meeting? Can you take Shawmary to an AA meeting? So Andrew was like the third in line. So at this point I was like, he's not an alcoholic. This is my aunt just going crazy and really needs an Al-Anon meeting. And then this one stuck. This one stayed in AA. And And it's been a gift because I saw him come in and I just watched him go from, like, not talking to talking. Like, you got to come to a holiday. The kid doesn't talk. And then through the course of his sobriety, he just started smiling again and he started talking again. And it's like sitting there with my mother going, Andrew's talking. You know, it sounds retarded, I know, but it's like it's just like this program works like no other. And it's as simple as not talking and talking. Discomfort and comfortable. And, you know, what I have to be grateful for, which I am super grateful for, are the people with time and the people with less time, the people with the same time as me. And, you know, if you're new, get a sponsor, get your big book, and start cracking. If you have some time and you're uncomfortable and you're going to jump through your skin or put your head through a wall, I've been there in the middle of a program with lots of sponsees ready to knock my own teeth out because I was so uncomfortable. You know, it's you can start it over. You can call your sponsor up and try to figure a way how to talk. I'm not a talker. I'm not honest by nature. And I've been points in my sobriety where I've been so uncomfortable, and all it took was a phone call to Stephanie to be like, I'm a mess. I can't stop crying. And I don't know what to do, and this is what's going on. And then it just starts. You know, James talks about a series of recommitting to the program. And that's been my experience, and I'm grateful for all the people that have paved this path. And Peggy and Van for starting this group, because this has been the most amazing experience that I've ever had in my life. So, thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Carrie.
Well, I feel like a rock star. Thank you. My name's Carrie. I'm an alcoholic. And Amanda said she appreciated Atlantic Group attire, and I was thinking she doesn't have to wear a tie and jacket in this 100-degree heat, but I do, too. It's nice to get dressed up, and I'd like to thank everyone for having me here to speak. I drank for 18 years. I started when I was 12 years old, and I finished drinking when I was 31 years old. And I drank because I wanted to drink, because my friends drank. I didn't know the reasons why I drank until I got sober, you know, some of the reasons. But I was a very fearful person. Amanda spoke about fear. And primarily that was the driving force behind my drinking, and it allowed me to not be myself. It allowed me to be another person. And I never wanted to be Carrie until I got sober, and quite frankly, sometimes I don't want to be Carrie, but I'm stuck with me, and I accept who I am today. You know, I drank a lot, and for a while it was fun. When I was a teenager, the only time I had fun when I was a teenager was when I was drinking. The only time I had fun when I was in college was when I was drinking. When I wasn't drinking, I was a miserable human being. So alcohol did a lot for me. I've heard it said a lot in these rooms that, you know, if I wasn't drinking at the time I was drinking, I might have killed myself. And I think, you know, maybe not, but I'm here today. And you know, it stopped working for me. Eventually, it stopped working for me like it did. It stopped being a social lubricant because I stopped being social. It stopped being a magic potion because it stopped being magical. It stopped being everything that I wanted it to be. And I became very sad when that happened. However, I didn't stop drinking. I kept trying to replicate that feeling. I kept trying to replicate when I was 18 years old and I got drunk and I met my first girlfriend in college and life was great. I wanted to replicate that feeling when I was 12 years old. And the first time I ever had a Budweiser and smoked a Marlboro cigarette with my friends in the parking lot of Belmont Racetrack, and I felt like I was the king of the world. I wanted that feeling when I was 31 years old. And I was coming out of a blackout in Central Park, you know, not knowing how I got there. Alcohol stopped working for me very early on. You know, in 10 minutes, what can I say? I think the best way for me to illustrate what it was like and what my life is like today is just to share what happened the last day I drank. It wasn't anything particularly spectacular. I had a few beers in my apartment with my friend Andy. After that, I don't remember much of what happened. It was a Saturday night in November. The next thing I remember was a bleak, dreary day in November, Sunday afternoon, and I was on the hill of next to the Metropolitan Museum of Art on 79th Street, coming out of a blackout, not knowing how I got there, not knowing anything. And I came to, it was about 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a gray, blustery day. I was there all alone, and I came to, and I remember looking up at the sky, wanting to absolutely kill myself, wanting to be dead. And I don't like using the word miracle too loosely, but something different happened that day. I was a guy that never asked anybody for help. I was the kind of guy that never shared anything with anybody, never shared an ambition with anybody, a dream, a desire, a hope. You know, I was afraid to tell people what kind of ice cream I liked for fear of being judged. I just didn't share anything with anybody. And that day, you know, I asked for help. I asked for help for somebody who 6 months prior to that was the facilitator on an intervention for me. My family had arranged an intervention. Well, specifically my sister had arranged an intervention with an alcohol counselor, and it was 6 months prior to that. And I was a very arrogant, very angry, very hostile person. And I'm not today, thanks to AA. And, you know, 6 months prior to that, this guy, I walk into an office, and a man, an older man, wagged a finger in my face and said, "Carrie, you're an alcoholic and you're a drug addict, and if you don't get help, you're going to die." And my response to that was something that I can't really repeat here. You know, there's a lot of profanity, and a lot of arguing, a lot of cursing, a lot of screaming and denial. And I stormed out of that office, you know, holding on to a tremendous amount of anger. But for the first time in my life, somebody threw the truth in my face. Somebody put that seed and told me that, you know, you're going to die if you don't get help. So it was that day in November when I guess I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I knew I needed help. Otherwise, you know, the course of my life was just going to continue going down the toilet. And I went and I made the phone call and asked this man for help, said I needed help. And that's how my journey in AA began. I had attempted getting sober on my own many times, you know, yoga, abstinence, you know. I would find a book on the street by some psychologist that, you know, sold 4 copies of this book, and I said, "This is the book that's going to change my life." You know, multitude of different things that I thought were going to change my life, and nothing ever worked. I said, "I'm going to go start working out." And so what I'd do is I'd have a hangover, I'd go to the gym, I'd sit in the steam room. I wouldn't lift a weight, I wouldn't run on a treadmill. I'd say, "Okay, I feel better now." I sweated this all out, and I'd go back, and I'd go home, and I'd go drink. You know, I was having hallucinations. I was seeing imaginary rats running across the floor of my apartment, and before I would get up off the floor, I would throw a shoe across the room to make sure they were gone when I walked across the room. And so when I get the chance to speak and I think about those things, because I don't think about them often unless I speak or I'm in a meeting and I'm sharing or I'm talking to somebody about my story, and I get frustrated with AA or I don't want to come to a meeting because it's too hot, those are the things that keep me coming back. And hearing people sharing those kind of things and identifying with those kind of things keeps me coming back. And, you know, I've been sober for a little over 10 years now, and, you know, my life is completely different. My sobriety, or my life, I shouldn't say, I'm not going to pigeonhole my sobriety, my life. My life, you know, is not a straight line. It's like a sinuous curve. You know, it goes up and it goes down, it goes up and down like on a graph. But always, I'm not saying more often than not, always, when it gets too far up or too far down, sometimes when it gets too far down, you know, the thing that always brings me back is AA. It's the program of AA. You know, and there are times over the years when I've kind of been resistant, and I'm telling this, I'm telling you this for a reason. There are times when I've been resistant to doing the things that got me sober and keep people sober. And it's when I go back to doing those things that my life always goes back to that line in the middle of the graph, and I feel better. You know, one of the things I'm doing now that I had stopped doing for a while is I'm reading once a week with a friend of mine. We're reading the Big Book together. And it's something that's very important to me and is a gift. You know, it keeps the program and it keeps the steps and it keeps my conscious contact with a higher power with me all day. Not 24 hours a day. I mean, it escapes me often during the course of the day. I get tied up, I get busy, I get self-involved, I get angry. You know, my ego goes crazy. But knowing I have that connection with someone where we read the Big Book, and I read Bill's story, and he talks about the destruction of ego, you know. And that's something, you know, just phrases for me. I'm sure everyone has their own phrase or their own series of phrases or sections of the literature or slogans that they hear. You know, I just think of that, and it brings me back to center, you know. Service, I've done a lot of service in AA. You know, I was a person that never joined anything, always was on the periphery, didn't want to be involved, thought I was too cool for all that stuff. You know, my home group's the 79th Street Workshop, so there's, like the Atlantic group, there's ample opportunity to do service. And again, it wasn't by my action, it was by a power greater than myself. You know, I started getting involved in service. I had about 60 or 70 days, and it was a Sunday, 6:15 in the evening, a meeting that I would attend. And the chairperson said, "We don't have a hospitality person. Who wants to do hospitality?" And I raised my hand. I don't know why. That was an action unlike any I've taken in my life. I said, "I'll do it." And I sat back there and I started getting to know people. And I liked that. I liked people shaking my hand. I liked saying hello to people. I continued doing service. I became active in the group. And all these things are the things that kept me sober and allowed me to grow. Wow, it's 10 minutes already. And with that, I'd just like to thank everyone again for having me, and thank you very much.
Our main speaker tonight is Shirley.
Good evening. My name is Shirley, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. I want to thank you so much for your warm hospitality and for you giving me this opportunity to serve, because this is the way I see it today. In the beginning, I didn't see it that way. It was an opportunity to show off. Maybe I'm auditioning for a play, but I've changed. I don't know exactly where to begin, so maybe I'll try the beginning. It seems to me, looking back now with clearer eyes, that I was born irritable, restless, and discontent. Before I knew how to pronounce or say any of these words, I knew what they felt like. I was an unhappy baby, so I'm told. You know, I believe they could have put a little scotch in my milk at 6 months, and I could have gone to rehab. But that didn't happen. So I suffered. You know, I did not like me. I was too short. I lived in a small town that was about maybe the size of this chapel. It seemed to have, you know, double windows on all sides. I felt like I was in a fish tank. And there were just rules, and I was a child, and I didn't like that. Children had no rights, and you did what you were told. You were seen and not heard, and there was no such thing as child abuse. So I stayed in a lot of trouble and often in a lot of pain because I could not keep my mouth shut, and I could not stop voicing, you know, my opinions about things. And this was at like 4 years old. What happened, I decided if I hung around adults, that I would be one. So that's what I started to do. By 5 years old, I was the best people pleaser on the planet. I hung out with my older brothers and sisters and relatives, and I became, you know, step and fetch this, step and fetch that, do this, do that, and I did it because I wanted to belong. And I didn't want to play games and skip rope and all that corny stuff because that was just, you know, it didn't do anything for me. One day at the tender age of 8, as I was bringing beer and other things to my older relatives who were watching baseball, loved baseball, I made a mistake and put the wrong chaser in somebody's drink, and I had to fix that. So I was looking at the one that was wrong and said, I wonder what this stuff tastes like. And I drank it down. It was cheap bourbon and something, and it was disgusting. Now, I believe if I were not an alcoholic, I would have never touched anything again. But when I stopped gagging over how awful it was, those millions of things that used to jump up and down in my chest slowed down, and then they stopped. And then I was tall. I was an adult. I was all these things that I, you know, wanted to be, and that was it. So from 8 years old until, you know, maybe 40-some-odd years later, this is what I sought, that feeling. And that's how long it took me to surrender to whatever these demons were that had me going. At that particular time, I realized that I had to change my MO. So I became this little goody two-shoes. I went to school, I got good grades, I wore those ridiculous little fluffy dresses and did all these things, took piano lessons, and at night, nobody was suspicious of me being a bad little girl, and I could go to my room and drink. By the time I was 10 years old, I was drinking every night, and I had a secret nobody knew. They had always called me weird, and so that's what they thought. She's just acting, you know, a little strange. My brothers used to say that I had this habit of sitting out in the backyard. There were no skyscrapers in this little town. And you could see the sky, you know, and all the stars. And I used to love to look at them. And they used to say, yeah, she's waiting for her real family to come and get her. Because they swore that I fell out of the sky in this round, shiny thing. So, anyway, that's what I did. I started being at least two different people. By the time I was a teenager, I was, you know, living two separate lives. One I showed you and the one that was just about me. But I managed to get out of high school and I went off to college, all academically clad with, you know, scholarships and what have you. And when I got there, the first thing I learned how to do was other substances. And at this time, it was the 60s. And I joined those groups of people who were going to change the world or blow it up, whatever came first. I wasn't always sure what was going on, but I was absolutely sure that I was against it. And that's what I did. I mean, I was this rebel without a cause or a clue. And I had all the enthusiasm and that you can muster up, going to do whatever it was that I was doing, you know. And, of course, there were these wonderful parties afterwards. When I finished school, I decided that this little town I lived in needed to be changed immediately, and I set out to do it. And I did not deal with the principles of the movement, like nonviolence and all. No time for that. No patience. And I started to wreak havoc on this poor little town. And my parents came to me and told me that they had been told by the chief of police that I would probably live longer somewhere else. So off they sent me to Brooklyn to live with my auntie. And I came to Brooklyn reluctantly. However, once I got there, right on the corner where she lived, I discovered another movement, the bar movement. Oh, my goodness. I went into this bar, and I was mesmerized. They had all these bottles, and it was dark and dim, and they had this jukebox, and, you know, and I sat down, and I was hoping I would never have to get up. I was an equal opportunity bar drinker. I did all the bars in Brooklyn, then I took to Manhattan, and that's what I did. And meanwhile, I still had this duality. 9 to 5, I had a wonderful career that went that way, and another career that started from 5 to 9 that was going that way. So don't tell me you can't go up and down at the same time, because I did it. They talk about this invisible line that you cross. And at some point, you know, probably in a blackout, I crossed that line, you know, because I thought I was, having fun, living life in the fast lane, and indulging in recreational substances. And I had so much denial, you know, that it never occurred to me that I was an alcoholic or any of those things, because I helped them in my career. I got hung up on what I had in a materialistic sense, saying, this can't be me because I have this and I have that. So there I was, still continuing my rebel without a clue. I started to have problems. You know, it was as if one day somebody put me in a rocket ship and I just took off, you know, like Air Shirley. And I crash-landed occasionally in the strangest places, psychiatric wards. And I hadn't noticed it, but my two worlds were beginning to cross lines. I was, you know, doing the wrong thing in the wrong place. And, you know, I was getting things kind of mixed up. And then things like going to work and paying bills and stuff like that started to interfere with my drinking. I had got angry with somebody on my job one day, and I went out to lunch, and I had 2 martinis, and I stayed about 2 years. You know, one martini led to another, and that led to what it led to, and, you know, and things just kept going on, and the longer I stayed out, you know, it was a disaster. I really don't know how I got away with that, except that maybe I was the person, you know, in charge of people who did stuff like that. And I just didn't have the integrity to fire myself. So I survived. And these things meant nothing to me. I, you know, put them in the category of, well, you know, she's a free spirit, she's strange. I bought and believed my own press clippings, which I wrote, so nobody could tell me anything. I crash-landed a few more times. And you know, meanwhile, my health was failing. You know, my job was ready to, you know, probably shoot me at high noon or something. But, you know, I didn't have a clue. You know, I blamed others, anything and anybody. It had something to do with everything but drinking. One day somebody said to me, you know, maybe you have a problem with alcohol. And I said, what? What problem do I have? I know what wine goes with what meat. I can make any drink. You know, I have a book. If I don't know how to make it, I can learn in 2 seconds. I'm a, you know, fast, quick study. What problem do I have? And they just shook their heads. Yeah. Okay. Well, this is a progressive disease. My health was failing unbeknownst to me. And I just kept drinking. And you know, to facilitate my drinking, I discovered other substances that would sober me up so I could get drunk again. And that's what my life was about. Get drunk, get sober, get drunk, get sober, get drunk. You know, it became that kind of a thing. Well, by this time in the progression of my disease, I was totally, totally dependent on alcohol. I had a large, very large bottle of Stolichnaya in my refrigerator that I kept cold because ice would dilute it. So you just pour a water glass of Stoli, you know. That's just to start your day so you can get dressed or something mundane like that. And everywhere I went, I was no longer sociable. I could not wait for anybody to give me a drink or to ask me or to invite me. I had to have what I had to have right then. So I traveled fully equipped with all the things I needed to get me through the day. That's how I traveled. Now, one particular day, I was going to a picnic. So I had my glass of vodka while I got dressed, and I packed up all my gear, and I got dressed, and you have to understand, I was a very tidy, color-coordinated drunk. That's where I left home anyway. And so on my way out the door, I decided that I needed a beer to walk with. It was a hot day like today. And I looked in my refrigerator, and I said, oh, I need this beer. St. Pauli Girl. It was green and white, and it matched my clothes. So off I go down the street with my coordinated beer, and some police officer had the nerve to come to me and say, you can't drink that beer. And I'm saying, excuse me? What do you mean I can't drink this beer? This is imported beer. Why can't I drink it? And she mumbled something about the quality of life and the mayor's BS. And she had no sense of humor. And she grabbed my arm to pour out my beer. Well, the nerve of her, I poured it out right here on her. She was not happy about that. And so she pulled out these handcuffs. And they're not, you know, the finest metal, you know. They're not even sterling silver. And she arrested me, the nerve of her. And she took me to this horrible place called Central Booking, and where they searched me and found things that I should not have had. You know, like drugs for which I had no prescription, and, you know, other things. And, of course, I was outraged. How could they do this to me? I am a solid citizen. I work, I do this, so I, you know. And how dare they? And this was the attitude I had when I went before the judge. Now, you know, I live two lives. And in my other life, that 9-to-5 one, you know, there are people who could help me, attorneys, all of them, you know, who I work with on a daily. But I can't call them because they don't know this person who has been arrested. They know the other person. So I made what I call mistake number one. I decided to represent myself. And in that process, the first thing I did was dismiss my attorney, you know, in a very abusive manner, because he just didn't know enough, you know, to represent me. I didn't like him at all. And I told him so, right in the courtroom. Well, the judge, you know, didn't like the way I talked to my lawyer, and he said so, so I let him have a little bit of it too. And, you know, I told him where he could go. And, you know, and how fast, you know, lots of other colorful metaphors. And he said, you're in contempt of court. And I said, of course I am. Wouldn't you be? What are you people doing to me? What is? Well, the next thing I heard rather clearly was 15 days. I said, I wonder what that means. That means that they put you on a bus that looks like a school bus, but you don't go to school. You go to this waterfront property place called Rikers Island. I do not recommend it. The hospitality is zero. They need motel management training. They don't know how to treat their guests. If you survive the intake process without getting shot, which somehow I did. You know, they wake you up when it's still dark, but they tell you it's morning, and they tell you you're going to go to the mess hall. Well, I got there, and they were right about that. It was a mess. And I remembered that I did not like the cuisine in Central Booking. The color of the bologna was a little off, like greenish, And I couldn't remember the last time I had something to eat. So I said, I'm going to do this breakfast thing because I'm starving. And I took one of the trays from the window, and then I said, may I please have a napkin? And everybody got hysterical laughing. And I couldn't figure out what was so funny. And a lady, whoever she is, she, you know, she had been there before, I could tell. She was quite comfortable there. Looked at me, and she said, witch, with a B, you're in jail. This ain't Club Med. And that was an awakening for me. All of a sudden, I understood the part I played in this process that I had just undergone. And in so many ways, that was the beginning of me beginning to suspect that something was wrong with me. So I decided it was those other things that I was doing. And I stopped them immediately to this day. But I still thought I could drink as long as I didn't pour beer on a cop. And I drank myself onto death row. I woke up in the emergency room with 17 stitches. I had gone through the windshield of a car, and the doctor said, you had a car accident. You know, I'm your doctor. I said, where's my lawyer? I'm going to sue somebody. Fast forwarding, you know, when I was getting ready to sue this person, he said, miss, I was parked at the light. You dived through my windshield. What are you suing me for? The sad part is I don't remember. I was in a blackout. And they told me while I was in this hospital, they found other health problems, very serious ones, which they were trying to treat me for. But I had my friends bringing me scotch into the hospital, which I was drinking. And a doctor finally told me, listen, we can't help you. Your blood is 86 proof. And if you don't stop drinking, you're going to die. And I said, well, can you give me an exact date? Because there was no way. I was not afraid to die. I was afraid to live without being able to drink. I had done it. It was a part of me. I mean, I would love to say something philosophically deep, like I drink, therefore I am. But it was deeper than that. You know, there is no point to anything without a drink. And I went home to my house and sat at my kitchen table, holding on to it for dear life, because I just didn't know what to do. I said, if I go outside, I'm going to drink. And, you know, and I just don't know what to do. And I sat there like that for a number of days. I don't remember how many. And then divine intervention took place. Some very good friends of mine, the best friends I have to me, looking back, came and took me out of my house and said, we're going to take you to a dance. And I said, not me. They said, well, you don't have to worry about drinking. It's a sober dance. And I said, what is that? They said, well, come and see. And I went to an AA dance. It was a holiday party. And they showed me people having fun and dancing. And they said, this person has 10 years, 25 years. And I said, yeah, right. I decided these people are too happy. Maybe they don't have any hard stuff, but I know they have some wine or something here. So I'm going to do the right political thing and get in the in crowd, and somebody's going to, you know, turn me on. So I started being a little friendly. And finally, one of the people there said, come on, I'm going to take you downstairs and get you something to drink. And I go, yes. And he took me downstairs and gave me a bottle of Poland Spring water, which I wanted to beat him over the head with. So my disappointment must have been, you know, showing. And he said, what's the matter? Come on, let's dance. And I heard Motown, the music of my generation. And I said, okay, you know, it wasn't his fault. And I started to dance. And it was an awakening of a sort for me. I found myself for the first time that I could ever remember having a little bit of fun without being drunk. or, you know, almost there or in the process of whatever we do. And I said, just maybe, maybe I can stop drinking and I won't die of boredom. About that time, another stroke of divine intervention happened. Two ladies walked over to me. They were like drill sergeants in the army. Hello, my name is Anne Marie. My name is Patricia. There's a meeting here tomorrow. You be here. And it terrified me. Now, that was a new thing for me. Nothing frightened me except not having any booze. And I was afraid not to come to the meeting. So I went to this meeting, my first AA meeting. And a group called Came to Believe. And I like to say, I came to believe that I was powerless over alcohol, that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity, and that I had to turn my will and my life over to this power. Because if I was convinced of nothing, I was convinced that I had made a mess out of my own life. And in that group, I started to learn to do something I never knew how to do, which was listen. I never heard anybody. I didn't know that. When you talk, these people up here, I call them the Intergalactic Council. When you start talking, they start talking. And I don't hear you. I hear them, but I don't know. I think it's you. So I'm not answering you. I'm answering them. And I know why my life was so confusing all the time. But I started to learn to listen. And I started to listen to learn. And I'm grateful. There were many people who helped me through this period. I'm grateful that for these two drill sergeant, old school AA people, because I know now that that's what it took for me. I knew everything. So I wasn't about to ask any questions. And if I didn't know, I wasn't going to let you know. And they would tell me, you know, well, why would you want to talk? You don't know anything to say. Well, that didn't keep me quiet. You know what kept me quiet? I was started to listen to the people in the rooms, and they said, this is about honesty, and you have to tell the truth. Well, I was convinced that I did not know what the truth was. I had lied so much until, you know, I mean, you could put the truth in a neon sign, and I would not know it. So I stayed quiet for a long time because I didn't know what the truth was. I did not know what the truth was. And as I learned to embrace this process and do the steps, I came to learn to make amends. The hardest one of all for me was to forgive. Because I was angry with the world. I didn't know I had done anything to anybody. I thought everybody had done all this stuff to me. So my fourth step list became my eighth step list. And the top of my list of my eighth step was my mother. Because I began to see that it could not have been easy being my mother. I never thought of her as a human being before. You know, she was just mom. You know, and she was supposed to do what she did. And that was so spiritually enriching for me. I learned about sponsorship, you know, because I had two wonderful sponsors. And they taught me many, many things, and so did all of you. But the most important thing I learned was that no matter what happens in my life, I don't have to drink. And last September, I stayed sober one day at a time for 10 years. And during those days, and I like to put them in days, I lost my mother, my two sponsors, two sisters, and a brother. And I'm not grateful that they're gone. I'm grateful that I did not drink. I'm grateful that I was able to be of service to the living. I'm grateful that no matter what life hands me, the answer is in our literature, in our fellowship, and in the process. I truly believe that I can't keep what I have unless I give it away. I do believe in sponsorship, and I believe it's a two-way street. You know, I have a wonderful network of many, many people, and I have sober friends today. You know, I had sponsors when I was out there. You know, they taught me how to get drunker, you know, and how to lie my way out of stuff. Today, my sponsors teach me how not to drink no matter what and to deal with principles before personalities. You know, I've learned how to deal with the message and not the messenger. I say the serenity prayer a lot. And I try not to leave my house until I am in the third step to the best of my ability. I'm keenly aware of what I do with my life when it's in my hands. And sometimes during the course of the day, I sneak out of the third step or I come out of it in a rage, but I'm thankful for the tenth step so that I can admit that I was wrong promptly and get back into the balance that I'm supposed to have. I do not naturally succumb to balance. I'm one extreme to the other. That's the alcoholic I am. And being in the middle is wishy-washy to me, and it doesn't mean anything. And I believe I'm endowed up here. This is the council speaking. You know, with the spirit of 10,000 warriors. That's why I have to surrender every day. I make morning meetings because the better I prepare, the less I have to repair in the evening. I am so grateful for this opportunity. I hope that something I've said will help someone to stay sober just for today. I thank you very much for this opportunity.